Is this the point?
Yes.
Oh, it's a yellow one, right? The yellow square.
No, they should be red.
No, no, yellow.
The yellow one.
It's supposed to.
That's what I'm saying, doesn't it? Maybe it's two. It's just a matter of batteries? Oh, I'm supposed to go straight.
Oh, okay. I think it's a lot. We have five of this.
Oh, we have five.
Not anymore, okay.
Batteries go into that? What kind of battery goes?
Particularly.
Double A?
Double X.
Hey, is that fundamental? Is there something physical that I can point to that's also fine?
That's the problem.
Rob to the point.
It was much more subtle. It has
no way with us.
Yes.
Okay. So thank you again. And we talked about this paper. Well, this paper is a sequence of previous papers with Miguel Costa regarding the problem of unitarity in the presence of closed dynamic curves. That is to say, the consistency or not consistency of field theory, or quantum field theory, or quantum gravity, or string theory, or anything that actually does work, can any of these theories make sense in a space where the causal structure is not the usual one, where there are closed dynamic curves, they're either formed or they're there forever? This question, as you will see, has implications that you might expect for black hole physics in the lower dimensions, like three dimensions, where this problem arises. But then I'm going to ask the question within the context of a model where I can actually say something, which is going to be a simplified model, obviously. So first of all, the free theory is always OK. That's never a problem somehow. You're just solving, in general, either the Laplace equation or generalized Laplace equation, depending on whether you have a scale of particles or something else. This is usually OK. The only thing you get, usually, is possible quantizations of energy eigenvalues. That's not the real issue. The real issue, as you all know, is when you turn on perturbations, when you turn on couplings, then everything breaks loose. In particular, unitarity breaks down immediately when interactions are turned on. And definitely, unitarity breaks down at the perturbative level, order by order, in the coupling constant. And we'll see exactly why this happens. But we'll conjecture and partly show, that is partly show meaning with a specific example where things work, that in these cases, unitarity is restored with just a discrete value of the coupling constant, that is to say, not at all values where things generically fail. So first of all, I'll discuss the model, which is an orbital model of three-dimensional space. The exact theory in which all of this is embedded will turn out to be irrelevant. So whatever high-energy completion you have of gravity, the only thing I will need is actually the existence of gravity. So, however, the theory is completed, the high energies will turn out to be completely irrelevant. So I'll be working in three dimensions with those coordinates, that flat three-dimensional space. And I will be looking at this specific field in direction, which is nothing but a linear combination of null boost j plus x plus a constant p is nothing but an energy scale that will parameterize in equivalent orbitals at the end. times loop translations in the minus direction, in the null minus direction. So that's my killing direction, which is better written in a new set of coordinates, in y coordinates. These y coordinates are nothing but a polynomial change of the original flat x coordinates written here. As you might expect, it always, whenever you have log boost, you always get parabolic changes, and therefore polynomial changes in coordinates. Introducing these new coordinates, the killing direction becomes nothing but translation in y minus, and the metric becomes of the form of the standard plane wave, dy minus dy plus, it transfers y direction, and a plane wave term, dy minus squared, times a linear term. As you all know, whenever you have a linear term, you don't have actually a plane wave, it's actually just flat space, we've done nothing, we've changed coordinates. It's flat space until one identifies y minus with y minus plus 1 over e. That is to say, I'm considering the order fold of three-dimensional space divided by the action of e to the kappa, where kappa is the killing direction. So this defines completely your order fold. Y, let me go back a second. So y minus in this metric is compact with the radius of 1 over e, with the circumference of 1 over e, and e is the only parameter which parameterizes different conjugate spaces of order. So that's the single parameter that you have to keep in mind. Okay, so let me just go a little bit into the geometry of this order fold. In the limit e going to infinity, you get the null boost order fold of Neumann of Cypher, but I'm going to keep e finite. It's very important to keep e finite. So first of all, y plus is another killing direction, so the d by dy plus is another killing direction, that is nothing but light cone time in this order fold. The order fold generator d by dy minus is null at y equals to 0. So you should think of y as a transverse direction. At y equals to 0, the generator is null, and it's time-like for y less than 0. As you can see here, this function h, which measures nothing but the square norm of d by dy minus, is linear in y, in the transverse direction form. So if you rewrite the three-dimensional metric in the usual Coulomb-Safin form, the two-dimensional metric that you get from here has a term which has the d by dy plus squared, so y plus, you should think of it as time direction, and then it has a transverse term as a function of y, and it's singular at y equals to 0. Now, this you've seen this type of geometry in ABS in BDC black holes, and in fact, this is nothing but a limit of BDC black hole. I'll show you in a second. This is the region inside the outer horizon of an extreme of BDC black hole, just to give you the punchline again. But it's very useful to work with this order fold as opposed to ABS3 black holes, because we will need to go to all orders in a couple of classes, and it's already incredibly difficult to do three levels in ABS3, or in ABS, in any ABS, particularly ABS3. So I want to focus in the region inside the outer horizon. So we'll have the Carnot-Vendros diagram is of this form, has a chronological singularity, not quite a singularity of the types in higher dimension, but still the singularity it is, chronological singularity at y equals to 0. And it actually does behave as singularity, as people that work in the insignificant know very well. So that's the from the two-dimensional point of view. From the three-dimensional point of view, which is somewhat important to keep in mind to do computations, so this is a picture which somehow gives you all of the details of the geometry. So horizontally is the transverse y direction. Time, or light cone time, if you wish, is going upwards, which is y plus. And then I have this circle, this compact circle, this y minus circle, is space-like on the right-hand side. It becomes null at the chronological singularity, and then it's time-like on the left-hand side. So obviously, this geometry has closed time-like curves, and these closed time-like curves, as, again, for people who are familiar with BDZ black hole geometry, they exist, they have to wind around the compact direction, and whenever they do wind, and they are time-like, they actually have to go behind, quote-unquote, the singularity. So any closed time-like curve will wind a number of times the compact direction, it will go past the singularity and come back with this curve. Okay? A very important feature of the geometry, which pops up immediately when you start doing one-loop computations in these geometries, be it string theory or field-directed computations, is the concept of polarization surfaces. The polarization surfaces are very easily described. If you think in the upstairs geometry in just flat three-dimensional space, the polarization surfaces are nothing but the surfaces where a point and its W image are light-like related. Now, the point and its W image are identified in the orthophone geometry, so they're actually the same point. So it means that wherever you have a polarization surface, you can send a light ray in the future and come back to the same point, okay, with a light ray. So these polarization surfaces are labeled by W, which is an integer, which tells you how many times you're winding around the compact direction, and they're located at transverse direction y equals W squared in units of one radian. So there are, wow.
Yeah, it looks.
Okay, so I'll just keep it going. Can you see the screen anymore? All right. So, so they're located at y1, y2, etc. They're further and further located out in the quote-unquote good region of space. So if you start from here, you go out with the light ray, you come in here, and you come back along the geodesic. And these polarization surfaces, if you draw them backwards here in the Penrose diagram, accumulate at W going to infinity to what here is null infinity and what is in the BTZ geometry the outer horizon, or the inner horizon, sorry, the non-extreme case. So the polarization surfaces are very important points, so they'll come back in a little while. So as I was saying before, the horizon is nothing but the W going to infinity limit of these polarizations. Okay, so that's the geometry, which is very simple. It's the simplest possible geometry, aside from compactifying time, where you actually have closed time. So now let me just review for you the relation of this geometry to the BTZ geometries, and in particular to the limit of obviously large radius. We have orbital of flat space, and the limit of large radius of the BTZ geometry. So a BTZ black hole is a three-dimensional black hole. It's nothing but, instead of flat space, we have three-dimensional hyperbolic, and the hyperbolic space with sitting to minus plus, divided by the action, again, of an isometry of the form e to the kappa, or kappa is one of the Killing isometries of E is 3. And I'm going to focus, just for simplicity, this has nothing to do with externality. The whole setup is BPS, but the has very little to do with computation. You could do the same computation for the non-extremal case. But at any rate, in the extremal case, the black hole mass and units of ADS radius is nothing but the spin J. Now, as we're used from the ADS CFT, this BTZ black hole is dual to a CFT state, which has spin and total dimension, which are related to the mass of the black hole, offset by, if you're working in the Ramanujan sector, by the ground state of the Ramanujan sector, and a spin, which is nothing, is the J of the angular momentum of the BTZ black hole. And from now on, I will be using this slightly unconventional choice of Planck mass, which will simplify a lot of 2 pi later. So just M is either 1, or if it's not 1, it's 1 over 2 pi G. Okay? So that's the choice that I will be using throughout. And we know that, in a, generically speaking, in a unitary CFT with fermions, we expect half integral spins. So we expect 2J, well, generically speaking, J, but if you are with the same geometry with periodic as opposed to antiperiodic boundary conditions on the fermions, you kind of have 2J being an integer. So now let's see what the, if you start from one of these, so we have a quantization condition which comes, if you want, from the boundary of ADS. Now, if you start with your extremal geometry, which is here on the left, this is the ADS BTZ black hole, that's the outer or inner horizon, it's the same here, that's the ADS boundary, that's the outside, that's the inside. If you take the flat space limit, where L is sent to infinity, and at the same time, J and the mass of the black hole in units of L are kept fixed, you can actually do the exercise, and you see that the ADS3 factor becomes free of the flat space, and you obtain the same orbital that I was describing before of flat space. In fact, you can see that the Cartier-Penrose diagram of the inner part of the BTZ black hole goes with the Cartier-Penrose diagram of the one that I drew before of flat space. So we're actually focusing in the inner region of the black hole. If we were to do this with the non-extremal case, You just do exactly the same exercise, and you obtain what in literature is called OOR system, or flat space, which is nothing but the region inside the outer horizon of the BTC. That's what you would get. So we're focusing on the region inside as opposed to outside. But we get an extra bonus. We get the fact that the remember that the whole thing is just parameterized by a single E, that the Planck mass in units of E has to be, well, normalized in a specific way, has to be integral. So you can think of doing string theory, for example, on M3 times some compact space. Put E at a specific value, which tells you what orbital you're actually working with. Then you can think of turning on the coupling, doing the usual string theoretical computation, or field theoretical computation, turning on the gravitational coupling, G string, so all the couplings come up together. And somehow, this is something you can't do that. You have to choose the values of the coupling constant at a very specific values, which accumulate in zero, but they're very densely accumulating in zero, but not all of them are correct. So somehow, this quantization condition is constraining either the coupling constant or the geometry of the orbital. You can't do the two things at the same time.
How do you derive this? Are you just imagining here? Are you just supposing here, or are you just getting
wrong somewhere? No, I'm telling you, if it is, if it works, this has to come out. Okay? The space is pathological anyway. So, I mean, so for now, this is just a suggestive argument that this might work. We'll derive this from purely field theoretic argument. There are a lot of primes and nothing at all. At the end. But I'm telling you that this is at least compatible with what's known about it is. Another argument which leads to the same formula has to do with the quantization of this from OH charge quantization. So this is string theoretic in nature. So we'll have to embed the orbital in type 2A specifically. So M3 over omega is our orbital. I'm just throwing in an extra compact P7 to go to 10 dimensions. And what I want to do is I want to consider this geometry not in 10, but in 11 dimensions. So I'm adding in an extra circle. So that's I'm uplifting the nth theory with an extra circle. And here are my 11-dimensional radius and Planck, 11-dimensional Planck length in terms of the original parameters of our spin theory, just strain and strength. And then I want to go down again to type 2A by compactifying along y minus. If you remember here, there's a compact circle of y minus. And then p-dualize along P7 cross S1. Okay, I'm not going to do this exercise for you. I'm just telling you the result. What you obtain at the end of this exercise, there is a Ramanujan field inside. There is a Ramanujan one form, which gets uplifted to a 9 form. That becomes exactly the OH plane geometry in type 2A. Okay, so if you do this exercise, it's very simple. It becomes an OH plane plane geometry in type 2A with a new L string and G string given in terms of the original parameters of your, well, it doesn't exactly matter, and with a specific tension of this negative mass object, with a specific tension, which is 4E over the Newton of the new 10 dimensional Newton constant, and this has to be, for a string theoretic reasons, quantized in units of the D8 brain charge, at least. Well, it's actually in the standard OH is 16 of them, but I mean, it at least has to be integrally quantized in units of the D8 brain charge. If you put all of these formulas together, you can recover what this meant from the original orbital of type 2A, and this means, again, the same formula on the quantization of M or E, or however you want to say it. Okay, so this formula has to hold again. This is either a reflection of the OA plane geometry, or which has very much to do with the singularity, or of the spin of the dual CFT state, which has to very much to do with the boundary of it. So it's not. So the two things are very much not matching. I mean, they're matching. What I will try to do is that you derive this by focusing in the region inside the singularity, but straight at the orbital level. So that's as far as the geometry and the motivation of this formula is concerned. So now I'm going to start something which is slightly more boring. The first part is rather boring because it's sort of somehow standard. But I need to set up some language to discuss. So what I want to do now is focus on the three-dimensional orbital geometry. Don't specify very much a theory. I don't want to specify anything aside from the fact that there will be some spin-J interactions, massless spin-J interactions with J going up to 2. And I want to discuss essentially free propagation of the scalar fields. Scalar fields just for simplicity. Okay, so first of all, let me discuss what are external states in my theory. The external states are obviously the usual ones. They're omega invariant scalar states. So these are states which satisfy the Klein-Gordon equation and are invariant under the action of the orbital inverter. So these are easily labeled by the mass squared of my scalar field, or generically, the mass squared could be negative, so I'm going to call it lambda if I'm working off shell. And by two conserved momenta, remember that we have two killing directions in our geometry, d by dy plus, which is translations in light cone Planck, and d by dy minus, which is translations in the compact circle direction. So we have a p plus, which is continuous variable, and a p minus, which is quantizing units of e. Okay? So this is nothing but comes to Planck. So the wave functions themselves, as always in these games, are sums over the action of omega on, for example, playing on anything, but in particular on plane waves, the simplest choice of space is the plane waves. So here is actually to fix the Klein momentum to be p minus, nothing but an integral over the action of omega to the s of any wave, weighted by an exponential. So exactly this integral, given the specification of the orbital, gives you a specific basis of states, which the exact form of which is not quite relevant. So they're, as I was saying, they're labeled by the mass squared p plus and p minus. They're given by this integral, which is the sum of the plane waves. The important fact is that the p plus here in the plane wave is fixed, because that's the left invariant like orbital action. And the p minus and the p are writing over, so they're integrated over, with a specific phase factor. So this phase factor will turn out over and over again. Okay? And these plane waves oscillate in the good region, so in the y positive region, and decay exponentially in the y negative region. There, well, you can do the integral explicitly, doesn't matter. So the most important thing is the propagator. So what I will be doing again is I need to go obviously to all orders in the coupling problem, the gravitational coupling concept in some way. So for sure I will not be able to do this in string theory because it's already tree level is hard, and one loop is harder, and it's impossible to go further. But there is one lesson from string theory that I want to take back to field theory, which is want to do everything in winding representation as opposed to Kaluza-Klein representation. So when you do string theory at the end, you're always summing over winding modes, winding double bonded prime series, for example, in one loop computation. Here in the end loop computation, I want to do things in winding representation. So to do that, I take my propagator given by the method of images, where delta is the usual final propagator, and this is the propagator from x to x prime. I'm always doing scalar fields for, again, for simplicity, everything could be general. The sum here, the single term for fixed w, is nothing but the integral over the three-dimensional loop momentum times two plane waves, the in and the out plane wave, at specific momenta, I will discuss this in a second, times the usual factor, minus I over q squared plus m squared minus I epsilon, times the phase. So this phase depends on w, crucially. So for a fixed w, there is an extra phase in the propagator. You should think of this as nothing but I give you a propagator which is now labeled not by just by a loop momentum, Q, by a propagator momentum, if you wish, but also by a label W, which could be Z. If it's zero, it's the old propagator. If it's non-zero, it's something where you have to put this usual propagator term times a specific phase. Okay?
And this propagator, sorry, this phase you quantize at the end of the day. Yeah.
No, the phase depends on Q minus and Q plus. And it just depends on the loop momentum. You will insert this into a standard loop computation and integrate over loop point and get whatever you get. The phase is just an extra piece that comes in. Okay. And the other important feature, which has to do with the fact that the two plane waves here are not the complex consequence of each other, is that the in, as you would expect, the in and the out momenta are not the loop momentum. So you should think of the loop momentum as somewhere in the middle. And the beginning and the final momenta coming in and out of the propagator are rotated by the action of the orbital, as you would expect. Because this thing, you should think of this propagator as propagating, winding a number of W times around the compact direction. So you should think of the in and the out momenta as being rotated by the action of the orbital group, and this extra phase. So these are the two extra ingredients in the propagator. If you do this, for example, for an S1 compactification, the usual S1 compactification, this is completely crazy. You could do this, but then this extra phase would just fix for you the momentum not to be continuous, but to be discrete and then value 1/2. What I want to do is I want to keep things in W as opposed to do a Poisson resummation and go to a Kaluza prime momentum. So again, let me just list in the final rules in this Wiley representation. So for generically, what I will consider is the existence of a spinless particle, which has to do with our in and out states, which could be anything coming from the delta from string theory or any of the scalar modes that go down to three dimensions. And coupled to, for now I'm going to call it the spin J massless particle. I will tell you what the J, well, the only J that really counts is J equals to 2. And this has to do with an old argument of 2 spin, but I will get to that later. So for now, I'm denoting the spin J particle with the wiggly line and the scalar one with the straight line. So a generic graph, I'm drawing here the specific graph I will be considering at the end, but let's just consider this as being a generic graph. First of all, you have to assign three-dimensional momenta for the external states. So three-dimensional, not the invariant states, just three-dimensional momenta. Then you assign winding numbers to all propagators. So to say each propagator, you assign a winding number. For example, the red one here has a winding of 0, the other one is a big one of 0. Then you compute the graph in the usual way, but with this x change, the usual vertices, but different propagators. So the propagators are just slightly modified. And then, just at the end, you average your external momenta to go back to the basis which is invariant under the action of the orbital group for the external states. Okay? Well, this gives you a specific expression, the form of which is not fundamental. So we are integrating over the transverse momenta ki, and here is our graph, which was computed before as a function of momenta and winding, and this is the phase. The phase is nothing but the sum over the phases of the that we had before for the single particle state. So this phase is again is the same one that popped up before for the single particle state. And then we want the sum over winding modes, not all winding modes, just the winding modes which are in equivalent. That winding mode defines for you the only thing which is really fair is windings around the closed loops. So if I choose windings at random, I will define for myself windings around closed loops. I just want the sum over in equivalent representations. So if I have two equivalent winding choices, they will yield different gamma W, for example, here. So they will yield different intermediate expressions, but the final expression will be the same. Okay, so this is what I want to do this is how I am thinking of doing either field theory, quantum field theory, if it exists, or string theory, if it's actually done this way. Okay, in obviously a much more generalized setting, but it's exactly what this is what you do. So what happens, so what really breaks down when you have a situation like this? What breaks down is the perturbative unitarity. And perturbative unitarity in either string or field theory is proved by using coupling rules. And the coupling rules break down exactly due to these winding propagators. So whenever you have a winding propagator which goes on shell, it usually goes on shell in the wrong place in the wrong place, and it does not feed in the order by order proof of unitarity. Okay. So let me just give you the trivialest of the examples, which is the tadpole. So the tadpole, you usually eliminate it, but for sure the tadpole, the leading tadpole in any field theory is a real object. It's a real object, it's imaginary part. This cannot exist due to, again, cutting. So this tadpole, you compute it in any, this tadpole you can compute any way you want, obviously. But if you think of this propagator as having a specific W, that's probably the best representation. So then I have some W in the end, but fix W for a second and consider the tadpole as a function of Y, the position Y. This object will diverge exactly at the polarization surface. when y hits w squared over 24e. It diverges there, nothing, just because the propagator, I mean, if you wish to prop the distance from y to its w image, which is actually what you're doing with the y propagator, goes to zero at the polarization surface. That is to say, the propagator is going on a shell. And the virtual particle running around the loop here becomes actually a real particle shooting forward in time and coming back to you at the same point. So what this means is that the final propagator here, delta, blows up exactly at y equals yw. Not only blows up, that's a problem in perturbation theory, if you want, but it acquires for w after the polarization, for y after the polarization surface inside the feather region, it acquires the famous I epsilon, or it acquires a branch cut with an imaginary particle, which cannot be accounted for. Cannot be accounted for because it should have imaginary particles to zero. Or this is imaginary particle order zero, cannot be anything except from zero. Okay? So that's the all of the problems that have been discussed actually a lot in various languages over the last 15 years, especially after the discovery of quantum machines, and people were discussing these sort of problems as formation actually of closed-time wave currents due to quantum constraints, have to do essentially with arguments, some more refined versions of this argument. Okay? So what I really want to focus on is not the tadpole, which is the simplest, also the tadpole will be resolved, but I mean, what I want to focus on is actually a two-point function to all orders, possibly. So the gray ones is all orders in everything, if we can do it. To all orders in coupling constants, describing for me the quote-unquote free propagation of scalar fields in the presence of the background gravitational field and all the other. Okay. So one is usually accustomed to think that this object is, if the particles still exist in the spectrum, is reasonably close to free propagation. It's reasonably close to free propagation, and at most loop corrections will change things quantitatively, but not qualitatively. Here it's actually complete, this situation is completely false. So for example, one of the leading terms to one loop is the coupling of this object, of the scalar particle, to the tadpole itself. So this is part of this graph, which is one of the leading one loop contributions. And this object here acquires exactly, is problematic exactly because of the tadpole. So if this particle here is spin 2, for example, this object is computing nothing but the one loop quantum Schwarzenegger tensor due to the presence of the scalar field. And this one loop quantum Schwarzenegger tensor diverges on the polarization surface, and this object is picking up exactly that divergence. Not only it's picking up the divergence, which again could just signal to break down the perturbation theory, but it acquires a non-vanishing imaginary part. And again, in that order, there's no decay channel for that part. Okay? So that cannot work. So we need to rethink slightly perturbation theory. In the best of all worlds, we would just do the whole perturbation theory, but we can't do that. So what I want to suggest, and I don't have, you can ask me, but I will not have an answer. This is just part of, there's a few pieces of guesswork here and there, and I will point them out right honestly. This is the first piece of guesswork. Okay, what can you do? Well, you can work to leading order in winding number, and to all orders possibly in non-winding number. So working at winding number equals to zero is nothing but the amplitude which you would have in the parent theory. Now, assuming we have control over quantum gravity in three dimensions, which is, okay, that's a problem that I will address later. Assuming we have control over, say, 2-to-2 scattering due to graviton exchange in three dimensions and flat space, I'm going to start adding a finite number, of winding propagations. So, for example, the full two-point function will have a contribution from graphs without any winding. This is nothing but the two-point function of the theory upstairs, down there. So this is what you would get from the parent theory. Then it starts having graph which has a single winding loop, then two winding loops, etc. I'm going to focus on the contribution from a single wind loop, which you can see has to do now with 2-to-2 scattering in the parent theory. of which one of the outputs comes back and finally becomes one of the inputs. Okay, so I will require again the control over 2-to-2 scattering in the parent, which is something which in certain limits can be understood to all orders in a couple of times. Yes?
Can you phrase these questions in this string language as well? Can you?
Absolutely, yeah, you can phrase this, the exact same questions in this is very little to do with field theory.
So you're saying some, so what?
And think of a generic graph, string theoretic graph. So you have a very high genus surface. Okay, you have a lot of, so the H1 of this surface is z to the 2 million. Out of the z to the 2 million, I want to put all of the coefficients to zero, in some, okay, we have to decide exactly what we mean by this, and then one of the coefficients to 1, or to none. Okay, so one of the loops around the surface, one of the non-trivial loops around the surface will have a non-trivial winding number, and all the other ones I'm going to resum with a lot of loops, a lot of small number of loops, higher number of loops. Mm-hmm. Okay? So let me just draw something, maybe it's cleaner. So suppose you have, what I want to compute is again a 2-point function. So in string theory, so you could think of having a very high genus surface here contributing to this. Okay? What I want to say is that, okay, for example, now, in principle, this is the sum of all the winding numbers on this graph. So winding numbers meaning non-trivial windings around the various non-trivial loops. I'm going to focus on the graphs where only one number is non-zero, and the other ones are all zero. Okay, but I'm going to sum, if I can, the number of zero handles, zero winding handles. So I want to go to all order in those. I can't do this in straight theory.
Yeah.
But in principle, if I could do it, I would do this in straight theory. Okay, I also cannot do it generically in field theory. So I have to restrict myself very much to a situation which I can actually have a handle to all orders in the non-winding sector and to some order, leading order in one of the lines. Will actually get is a problem of UV finiteness of the theory, because you will not be able to use modular invariants to cut off some data. So, okay, but that's not, that will turn out to be not the issue. This will be an infrared. So I don't think it has very little to do at the end of the day with. I agree that this is, in field theory, one winding, two windings is clean. Already two windings has a gauge invariant. So you can. How can I say this clearly? In any of these situations, you can choose. Choosing windings has to do with. So I give you on a graph a specific context, a specific winding set. Then I tell you what is the combination of winding of each propagator such that it gives you my it gives you again my choice of windings. And among the set of those, I choose the one which has the smallest number of propagators with winding different from zero. This is a well-defined procedure in field theory. In string theory, I haven't done this. It's so much far ahead from what one can do that I haven't thought about how to do it sensibly. Obviously, you're forgetting some basic pieces of. But on the other hand, the UV completion of string theory, which I don't think had anything to do with this. But we can probably discuss it at the end when maybe I could. Okay. So at any rate, this is the object I will be focusing on. And so that's the two-point function I want to focus on again. So let me again give you the the graph a little bit cleaner. This is the in and out state. They're labeled by P plus P minus, obviously the same because they're conserved. And in principle, I can do the computation of shell lambda and lambda prime. But for within here, if you want to use the details, you can go to the paper. And you're going to do the computation of lambda equals lambda prime equals to zero. So I have to choose. So again, this has to do with our understanding of the four-point function in the parent theory to all orders in the coupling process. So we can't do a generic kinematics, otherwise we will not be able to do this in any sense. So the correct kinematics that leads to something interesting is P minus takes, though P minus is discrete, so it's very, you cannot play around with very much with it. That's the consequential method. P plus going to zero, so very low energies. So P plus, remember, is nothing but the energy in light on time, so light on time. So remember that the first step had to do with put three-dimensional momenta k and k prime at external limits and average over those in order to get the gauge invariant, orbital invariant in certain states. That had to do with the phase, which is this chi of kappa, which in the limit p minus going to zero has a very nice maximum or minimum, so that the integral over the external states, the average over the external states, can be done by Saturn. So that's the first simplification. It's not the crucial one, but it's the first simplification. So this, at the end of the day, I will be computing not the generic three-dimensional momentum outside, but at the saddles, which have to do with k equals plus and minus p, where p is nothing but square root of 2p plus p minus. So at the end of the day, I'm actually computing my graph, let me go back a second, at external momenta k and k prime, given by this, p plus, p minus, and p, minus p plus, minus p minus, and again p. Momentum does not need to be conserved because it's actually broken by the existence of the winding property. Okay? So this is one contribution, and the other one is the other saddle. So there's two saddles to be worked to be one. Okay? So now what do we need to do? We need to do the loop integral over the winding momentum q. So here it is. That's the loop integral, that's the propagator. I'm choosing everything masses here. That, remember, so that's the propagator, that's the winding propagator. So that's the usual propagator, and it's added phase, which you have to put in for non-zero delta. Then you have the amplitude, the four-point amplitude. Okay, the four-point amplitude comes in two pieces. It comes with a three-dimensional energy momentum conservation delta function. That's right here. You see that the two momenta coming in are k prime, a rotation of the loop momentum, and the opposite rotation of the loop momentum. As I was telling you, the propagator has the in and out momentum rotated by the action of the orbital. And then there is the amplitude itself computed at S, T, and U, which depends specifically on Q, not a fixed specific form, is not quite important. Okay. So that's the loop integral that you have to do. First of all, two of these delta functions, which all these three delta functions would be trivial if you didn't rotate the momenta, but now the momenta are rotated, so two of them become non-trivial and fix Q plus and Q. So they're leaving one integral here as opposed to three over q minus. So that's the first, the second simplification. Well, this is not a simplification, this just comes out of the computer. Okay? So that's, so these three delta functions, one of them is just has to do with time translation, so that goes away. The other two fix two of the integrals, you're left with a single integral. And we're going to be working in the limit, so as I was saying, the specific limit is p plus or equal to zero, this is the exact bound that you need to satisfy in order to do the computation. And the Mandelson invariance at this point, S, T, and U, is a function of Q minus, here they are very simple. T is fixed, so T is nothing but the fixed number, minus T, P squared, and S and U run with Q minus. So what we have is T fixed, and U is nothing but S minus a constant, where the four-point function is computed off-shell, clear, because the winding propagator is off-shell, but with t fixed and s and u at a fixed distance. And we're integrating over q minus, which is again over s. So the two saddles give you two contributions, gamma plus and gamma minus. I'll tell you what they are in a second. Multiplied by constant c and c. See that there? And here is gamma plus and gamma minus. They're integral over s of the amplitude of s, t fixed, u as a function of s, which we had before. What is left of the phase times this, which is nothing but what is left of the winding property. So that's the expression. Add the two saddles plus and minus, and reality to two-point function, that is to say, absence of decay of the imaginary part, translates into the fact that gamma plus and gamma minus have to be one in the complex conjugate of the other. So now we need the control over the amplitude itself. The control over the amplitude itself requires that I remind you of partial wave decomposition and Iconal expansion in three dimensions. Four dimensions is more standard. Three dimensions, I'm not sure if it's very standard, so I will just review it briefly. So let me go first on shell for a second. If you have an amplitude of S and T, and 1 plus I as the amplitude has the span of partial wave decomposition in terms of the scattered angle theta, which is right here, and the phase shift delta sub A. And unitarity implies that the imaginary part of delta A is possible. Okay, so that's the standard plane wave, partial wave decomposition. In the smaller angle limit, when theta is much smaller than 1 and T is much smaller than S, the sum over N can actually be replaced by an integral over impact parameter X. And one thing is the approximate expression, 1 plus IA, is nothing but the Fourier transform of the exponential of the phase shift, delta, which now depends on S and X. And the leading contribution, which tells you what delta should be, this is just heuristic, I mean, you can do all of this more cleanly, is that the tree-level amplitude is nothing but the Fourier transform in transfer space of the phase shift, or vice versa, the phase shift is given by the Fourier transform of the tree-level amplitude. So you take the tree-level amplitude, you Fourier transform, you get the phase shift, you exponentiate the Fourier transform that, you get the equivalent expression to all orders in the couple of months. So there's various derivations, which have to do either with control, with looking at high energy behavior of final diagrams or classical field techniques a la Tuff, where you look at the classical field generated by one particle and the scattering of the other particle classically in this field and look at what happens in completely amplitude. They give the same answer. And what we want to focus on is the existence of a mediation due to spin J particle. So the tree-level amplitude is nothing but S to J or T to leading order in angle. Okay, there's some leading terms, obviously, but that's the leading one. Times flat mass of the 3 minus 2j. I'm choosing the normalization to be the correct one for the spin 2 case, obviously, but the other ones, I'm assuming that the coupling constant in flat units is of order 1. So here it is again, the flat mass is, again, I'm choosing the same normalization, m over, it's 1 over 2 pi g. And then from now on, for a little while, I'm going to choose for simplification the formula n equals to 1. So for any j, I'm choosing unit couplings and Planck units. And the phase shift is very simple. It's nothing but negative, first of all, and linear in the transverse impact graph. Okay? So this is very simple to understand, for example, in the j equals to 2 case. Remember that this is scattering of one particle off the other with gravitational interaction. In particular, in three dimensions, the particle creates a conical singularity. And so this is scattering in the presence of a conical singularity. And you can understand rather cleanly that the phase shift of a particle coming in the presence of a conical singularity is linear in the impact fraction, growing linearly and negative. So this is rather simple to understand in the J equals to 2 case. Okay? So this is what happens. And now you can integrate back and get the full Iconal expression. Here there is no A, I'm using N equals to 1, but this result is to all orders in the coupling constant, in the Newton constant. So there's an extra M that should go into here, which then expanded gives you order by order in the Newton constant. And this turns out to be the sum over cross-ladder graphs. Okay, so it's the tree level, the 3 plus the tree level plus graphs of this form. Okay? So the nice feature in three dimensions versus higher dimensions is that this Iconal expression is, when on shell, is a polynomial expression. It's very simple. It's a rational expression in S and T. And it possesses poles, which are usually denoted in four dimensions by S two poles. Right here, when the denominator goes to zero, two poles, which are, on the other hand, in the physical region of the scattering process. And this can be understood rather easily if you look at the imaginary part of this, which has to do with the sorry, the, well, in this case, the real part, there is an extra I here. If you look at the real part here, it has to do with the delta function contributions at the post. If you didn't have all the sequence of interactions, the single one here, which is nothing but free propagation, would give you a result 4 pi s delta of square root of minus t. That just tells you that the particles have to fly by at zero scattering angle. Now, this object gets replaced by two terms, which tell you that now the scattering angle is not fixed at zero, but it's fixed at the angle that you would do at the conical singularity. So a particle comes in and flies off at a fixed scattering angle. That scattering angle is exactly where the iconal amplitude diverges. It picks up the pole with a specific imaginary real part, depending if you look at amplitude of 1 plus I times the amplitude, which is given by this. Very careful with the epsilons because they're all crucial in this case. So what I want to focus on is a specific kinematical regime. So what counts for an iconal is not quite large S. Counts large S compared to T. So both S and T could be large ratio of kinematical effects. So what counts here is that S is much bigger than T, but they could both be very much below the Planck scale. So this is exactly the situation I want to consider. So I want both S and T much smaller, and well, also S squared of the order of T. This will come out later. So I want to be in this situation. And then I can look at the various contributions from the various spin interactions, J0, J equals to 1, J equals to 2, for example. And if you just take the formula I gave you before for the iconal expression, you will see that the dominant contribution in this sub-Planckian regime of three dimensions is actually the spin 2 particle. So even if you have some leading spin 0, say for example, you have a Dilthoff exchange, they will be completely sub-dominant in this regime compared to the graviton. Okay, so the first of all, the J equals 2 graviton dominate, so from now on I will fix it, stick with J equals 2. And the tooth pole in this kinematical regime, well, if you follow it correctly, is actually reliable, that is to say, within the correct approximation. So the pole happens when the iconal approximation technique is reliable. Okay, so this is, in four dimensions, for example, things are very different. The graviton dominates in super Planckian regimes. Here, in three dimensions, it just happens that the other way around, and it's very important for what I want to do later. So now let's look at again at the J equals 2 amplitude a little bit more. That J equals 2 amplitude rewritten in two different ways, A plus or A minus. Now I'm writing in terms of three variables, S, U, and T. Now I'm on shell, so S is roughly speaking minus U, T is subdominant. But I want to write it like this for a reason that will become clear in a second. But at any rate, what it looks like, it looks very much like in either way you write it, as S minus square root of minus T, or plus U minus square root of minus T. That is to say, it looks like an effective exchange of a particle of mass square root of minus T, plus or minus. Okay? So in the S and U channel, so you're resumming graphs of. You're resumming graphs like this. Okay, and this looks very much like an exchange of something of this form. Plus the, that's the S channel plus the U channel. Okay. So that's what it looks like. So now I'm going to consider an off-shell generalization for the kinematics. So remember that before, all of these four legs were at mass squared equals to zero. Now I'm going to put the two legs, k1 and k2, at the mass squared, which is different from zero, but equal. Okay. And so now, S and U will not be one the opposite of each other, but tell you the at the end of what type of gesture is required, but at the end of the day, the only thing that, the amplitude will be for sure symmetric in S and U, and it will have poles I will assume it still has poles at the correct, at the same points due to the exchange of that particle. So at plus or minus square root of minus t plus I x. Okay? So to get the full icona, I will discuss it again. So this is the second piece of the slide case, right? It's not very much interesting, but that's what it is. And for an example of what form it could take, so I'm not thinking that, I'm just thinking this as a simple example to discuss what happens, is a linear combination of a plus and a minus, so the one which we had before, and the only condition you want is that a plus a minus is 1, to be compatible with the off-shell icona which we had before, and the off-shell trinical which we have. Just a second. So now we have our four-point amplitude in place. We can go back and conclude the computation. So remember that what we really needed to understand is is these gamma plus minuses, which have to do with the two saddle points, which are nothing but integrals over S with t fixed and u given, t fixed at this value and u given by S plus a constant, times the phase factor from the propagator plus or minus and the winding propagator. Now, exactly in the limit when p minus is going to zero, so that can map a regime which we could reach already at this point, the amplitude here is actually in the Icona regime. So I'm reinserting the m squared stuff. So we're now really in the Icona. This amplitude here in this regime is the Icona. So, well, the out particle, which is coming back in time and becoming an input, is interacting extremely strongly with the particle which is coming in and out, and extremely strongly compared to the momentum exchange. So this integral over S now has to do with the poles of the integrand, essentially. So now it's very simple. Has to do with the poles of this integrand here, which come from either the amplitude itself or the propagator. Okay. So I'm here putting in the S plane. So there is a winding propagator down. First of all, in the S plane, due to the phase factor here, depending on whether it's plus or minus, you either go up in the upper half plane or in the lower half plane. So the gamma plus poles are up here, the gamma minus poles are down here. The winding propagator, which is the only contribution you would have at tree level, so is in the lower plane. And then you have extra four poles due to this particle exchange here, this pseudo-particle exchange from the amplitude. 1, 2, 3, 4. Remember that those replace the free propagation. These poles replace free propagation. Okay? So these four poles in S plus this value, U plus this value, and minus them are correctly drawn above or below the S line. And so you start from here, you can use any amplitude for just for simplicity of the slide, and using this amplitude here, this example's amplitude, a plus times linear combination of the two expressions we had before. And you can compute, just at this point, the integral, and you get gamma plus and gamma minus, modulo overall constant, is given by these two expressions here. Okay? So for all values of that. So unitarity, the fact that this is the complex conjugate of this, implies two things. Implies, first of all, that this phase has to be 1. And this phase being 1 is exactly m over 2e within 2 pi z. For all values of w, that's the only choice you can have. And this is exactly what we were getting from either ADS-CFT or O8-plane quantization. For any little a. For any a, yes. Yeah, this part here goes for any a. And then, given a specific a, there is an extra condition on residues. Okay? An extra condition on residues, in this case, it's nothing but a plus plus a minus equals to 1, which also happens to be the correct one here for this example to be compatible with what it's not. This piece you get in general, regardless of the a. That piece you get, it's a condition on the residue, whatever it is. In this specific example, that's what it is. So let me just conclude with a few notes and the list of things, very small list of things. So first of all, just to put you back on more standard territory, what would happen at tree level if you just use the tree model level result for the four-point graphic. Well, there, the computation you would get would be this. At the end, this would be the dominant contribution for the two-point function right here, where this is the one propagator, and this is just the tree level piece for the four-point graphic right here. Okay? Then, out of these three terms, you would just get the minus one, which comes from the Wyman property. So you get gamma plus equals to zero and gamma minus equals to minus one. And this clearly violates unitarity, and this is the computational version of what I was telling you at the beginning. But I mean, imaginary parts can exist in two-point amplitudes. They just have to do with, again, the k-channels. And first of all, if your particle is stable, they don't exist. But I mean, they could exist generically. But here, really, we're dealing just with a regime in the kinematics where the interaction is iconal. And iconal-like interactions are transverse by definition. They're transverse with no P plus exchange. So there's really no way to take a single particle, split it transversely into a lot of particles with positive P pluses. So there's really no way to have a K channel to account for any manner of part. So this is perfectly fine. And the results that we will take are in energies which are way below any scale you want. I mean, this has very little to do with string theory scale. So in particular, it should be completely independent of any high energy completion of your theory. The only thing that's required is the existence of a spin 2 particle in the beginning. So any high energy completion is irrelevant. And also any number of dimensions which you might have extra. Really, we're going to have an energy which is low enough that the higher dimensional nature of interactions disappears. That is to say, the supply of momentum exchange disappears. So really, we're in a regime in which the three-dimensional approximation is completely correct. But it could be that at higher energies, the gravitational interaction is dominated by a higher dimensional interaction, but when you go to a low enough dimension, really, it is truly three-dimensional. So let me just conclude by saying two things that need to be done rather soon. I mean, if this problem is can go anywhere. First of all, is the extension, what is the form of A at the end of the day? Well, I've been trying this for a long time, but I mean, it's rather complicated for a reason which I wouldn't have expected at the beginning. That is to say, take the usual computations for iconic scattering, it's computations done in the 60s, 70s, if you wish, for high energy behavior final data, so you just put in an extra slight off shellness of one of the two of the legs, and you start getting more, already generically you get infrared divergences from dimension 4 and lower. These infrared divergences in the usual on shell case can be resummed up very explicitly, and the resummation is just not the same expression I gave you before. You get slightly more infrared divergences in this case, which are very difficult to handle. And it's a technical problem that I've talked to a lot of pure field theorists about, and they're not quite sure what to do with it, but that's the first technical thing that I would like to address, is to really do the resummation and understand how this thing works exactly. And the second thing is extend these results from just not the two-point function, but generic real interactions, like four-point function, three-point function, four-point function, and this will immediately require understanding M-to-M scattering amplitudes in the parent theory. And there is some literature of the extensions of the iconal in three dimensions, again by Tuft at the end of the 80s when he was thinking of three-dimensional quantum gravity. He had a lot of results of M-to-M scattering, which generalized these polynomial results in a different language that one has to recast in this language, but possibly using these results to generalize these computations to real scattering as opposed to just free propagation. Thank you very much.
Any other questions?
So can I interpret that I can build a time machine
you can clever enough to choose the plank scale, local plank scale correctly.
Well, the point is that this is, at the end of the day, this is not the French. So if you wish, this is, it's a dynamical chronology protection. Because at those values, exactly those values, even though your space-time and your intuition tells you that there is a chronology violation, I mean, people coming back on you, this actually does not happen, because what you're neglecting, essentially, is very strong interactions of these images of yourself coming back. The interaction of loops in time is rather science fiction, looking on you, but the interactions are so strong that your intuition, order by order, becomes concentrated. So at the end of the day,
all the corrections.
If you sum over whatever you can sum over, which is the interaction of you with a single, say, winding loop of yourself, and the interaction of you with yourself, then the resulting propagation is possibly very different from the one which we naively expect from the space time, but it's definitely human time. So it doesn't violate anything that you could have pick up from science fiction movie. On the other hand, I mean, the space-time is still with cosmic curves. Somehow it's dynamically protected from chronology as opposed to being just put in place from the start with a specific geometry.
So how can you tell that there are close timeline curves?
That's another question.
You can't tell from scattering.
No, you can't tell, that's right. But I'm telling you, at this point it's a matter of, it's a philosophical question. Definitely you can't tell. The point is that there are certain you're completely correct. I mean, you cannot play. One is that at the end of the day, the propagation. It would be one of the nice things that would be nice to do is try to recast this as a propagation which is close to a propagation in another space. This might be completely correct. But I can tell you what we did slightly more is that we looked at the Tuman function in the off-shell regime, when the in and out states are off-shell, and this essentially gives you it gives you the free propagation at the effective action level. So you can look at the quote-unquote Clyde-Morton, the correct Clyde-Morton equation with this extra term, and what happens is that there's a wall at the singularity. So the propagation looks like essentially free propagation up to the wall, and then there is a reflecting boundary, roughly speaking, a reflecting boundary exactly at the wall. So the propagation is rather different from what you would expect, and clearly it could be just that it's mimicking some other space with no cosine. So that's what I'm saying, is a dynamically protected. At the end of the day, what is metric and since what is metric is very difficult to say because the gravitational interactions are so strong, even at very low energies, very strong at low energies, because you're interacting very strongly with yourself, that you can't tell.
But this is only for specific ratio.
That's right. Only for these values. Otherwise, the usual pathologies that you can think of just happen immediately, and then all hell breaks loose. I don't know.
So if you cut the ground, do you expect to be unitary?
I mean, if you cut the graph here, you get zero. And you get zero on both sides now, as opposed to zero just in one side. Obviously, this is it's an example where a kinematical regime and it's such a specific example that you might say, okay, too specific. Well, first of all, as I was telling you, it's not that specific, it's the BBZ black hole. So, okay, people have been working on it for 20 years, but not the next piece of information. But I would not have expected that something like this could even happen. Then again, your comment is completely correct. It's unclear that you can decide if the space does have those.
Any other questions?
Have you thought about how this works with the normalization? Like,
it's has very little. Again, the Kolmogorov results don't even. I mean, the UV part is always okay. The UV part of the Kolmogorov graphs is always fine. Somehow, even the fact that you can do just I mean, the graphs will be something of those. The other ones supposedly are subdominant. Obviously, then there's the question, if the good approximation is correct, and then that humongous literature, which I'm not going to get into. These graphs, in specific the regime in which t is much smaller than s, don't have any UV problems.
I guess I was thinking more of the one.
Since it never, really never shows up.
Yeah, it never shows up here.
That's right. Yeah,
it's not that it's implicit that somehow the UV completion has to be super scattered.
No, I don't think so. I really don't think so. The whole setup here is super symmetrical for just because it's extremely gazebo. But it, up to here, it really didn't require anything of that nature.
They appear
because, well, simplest, they appear because when you're thinking of ICOMO, what counts is the transverse interaction. So what dominates the interaction has to do with the transverse propagator. The transverse propagator in interactions in four dimensions is two dimensional is logarithmic, because that starts that way. In three dimensions is linear, which is exactly this linear trap, which we saw somewhere throughout the plot. And this is what's giving you the divergences. On the other hand, so just to give you an example of how these things diverge in the IR, you would have integrals of the form e to the I q x, x is the impact parameter, and then e to the I delta of x. Okay? So this is the full amplitude, and this is the either like qx times delta of x. This is the tree-level result. So if you put the tree-level result, say here, you put absolute value of x, this divergence for large x, so it has an infinite divergence for large x. But when you resum it up exponentially, this divergence disappears. So the equivalent result is resolving for you the infrared divergence order by order of the coupling thoughts. Now, the same thing should happen also when you go up shell, it's just much more complicated. I mean, it would be a completely another topic. It's much more technical. That's roughly speaking how it works when you're on shell. Yeah, something which this Q is this momentum transfer, not just at all values of Q, but just a specific value of the momentum transfer, when this cancels this extension. So at those values, the thing blows up and gives you these poles, which are two poles. And those happen to be just in the right place, that they cancel whatever bad part comes from this loop going back and forth. So those infrared divergences are good, so you want.
Other questions? Now let's start with the
I'm going to be here. See you next year. Very good.